shofar, the music that that comes out of the ram's horn. It, one of the things that I immediately think about is that, you know, what kind of music, what kind of instrumentation, vocalization, lyrics are we likely to enjoy in eternity? What do you think?
Well, you have to first figure out what we're going to be like in form, which is a little is a big leap for my brain, you know.
But well, in well, for the most part, in form, yeah, and the most part, we won't have form, you know, when we're when we're in the seventh dimension, yeah, we'll be at, we're an energy based entity, but. Since we will still be able to communicate, there's lots of ways to communicate. One of them is music. And the fact that Yahweh talks about blowing the shofar, trumpets, drums, that sort of thing. And his all-time favorite guy wrote lyrics to songs, which he played with a accompanied with music. It's obvious he likes music.
Oh, yeah.
I would say that the type of music that you're probably going to hear are things that are inspiring. I can't hear, I cannot hear a shofar. I've never heard a shofar yet being blown to where I do not feel
uplifted.
Uplifted or a sense of power.
Yeah, empowerment, inspired. Yeah.
Yeah. And so so that's the kind of we will have music that will make you feel something.
Yeah, I would agree that heighten your senses, create a sense of expectation.
It's the same with drums. Think about drums.
You
start hearing the beat of a drum, and it's like, okay, all right. You know, a lot of times, obviously, people realize this at some point because they have drums of war and things like that. But when you hear drums that aren't played like that, but are meant to inspire without projecting fear, it is inspiring. It is it is uplifting. So I assume that's the kind of music you're going to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I really like horns. So the shofar is a spectacular horn sound. So I think I'm going to be happy with that. But I also like ballads. I'm a huge ballad fan, where the melody is beautiful, but the lyrics are clear. They tell a story, and if you listen to the Psalms are in a way like ballads. So if you like the great harmonizing ballad singers, I think you'll be in pretty good stead there too. If hip hop's your thing, you're in trouble.
I want a little shout out to Frank, our buddy Frank. He was playing a shofar last. We checked in with him last week, and he did quite good.
Oh, wow.
Even the roots.
Oh, man.
Hip hop now.
They blow it for me.
If you're a fan of hip hop now, you might be in trouble, but where it comes from is different than what it is at this moment.
Yeah. That's true.
So at one point in time, it wasn't all about, hoes and money.
Gang banging and
gang banging. At one point in time, it was a very uplifting. If you listen to early 80s hip hop, it is totally different.
Yeah, it's kind of like rap. Rap can be interesting, can be used to tell a story. It's just that the vast preponderance of it is pretty derogatory. Fairly derogatory. I was sharing an article that was written by a Nitsky aficionado yesterday. The article was not only is God dead, the culture of the West, particularly Christian capitalism, killed him. And the article is kind of an interesting article, but the premise of the article, I mean, how many times have you guys heard God is dead?
Well, all through the 60s and 70s.
Yeah. You know, and what's interesting, it's always touted by an intellectual. And when I was writing back to Roy, I said, listen, I'd like you to read the article because I think some interesting insights by this atheist in the article. But on the premise of the article, God is dead, if God... then not dead. If God was, he is. And if not God, then God cannot be dead, because to be dead implies previously existing. So the notion of God is dead, no matter if God is or is not, is irrational.
Mm-hmm. Well, consider if he's dead and Yah is his word, mm-hmm. Torah is his word, etc., mm-hmm. and Yahshua and so forth, mm-hmm. and if the world is being held together by his word, which is one of the early meanings of the word, Dabar, then if he dies, everything would be dead, wouldn't it?
Oh, well.
The universe can't be held together by something.
Yeah, the universe, yeah. If Yahweh no longer exists, the universe wouldn't exist. If he no longer exists, there would be no life. If he doesn't exist, nothing. Everything that we know exists because of him. And the idea that someone that is capable of conceiving over a $15 billion experience from our perspective could have set it all in place and then somehow succumb is beyond absurd. One of the reasons it's beyond absurd is that no matter how many dimensions the universe is, and, you know, personally, I'm convinced it's six. And I'm sure that there, I mean, if somebody wants to debate that, I have no problem. You know, whatever floats your boat. Personally, six is the number that resonates with me. But no matter how many dimensions of the universe is, let's say that it's four. We know that it's a minimum of four with, the three dimensions that we all understand well, plus time. So we know it's at least four. The universe could not have been created by a being that's four-dimensional. It would be impossible. So the being has to be at least outside of four. To be in the fourth dimension, to actually be fully integrated into the fourth dimension, which is time, you have to be an energy-based light form. Have to be. You cannot be in the fourth dimension, which is time, unless you are akin to light. And if you're energy, you can't be destroyed. So the notion of a creator God dying is impossible, because the creator God has to be at least five dimensions, and if you're only four, fully four dimensions, you can't die.
Which explains the Moloch.
The main reason the Moloch exists is because as a as an energy form, they're able to transition through the dimensions, and so they can't.
So they don't disturb anything if they go through the dimensions either.
Correct. Yeah.
Blow it all up.
Correct. And it's the only way, really, that Yahweh can interact with his creation and fine-tune things. He does a lot of fine-tuning. Chuck, sent me an article that confirmed something that I wrote earlier in Observations for Our Time. And it was when Yahweh wrote and said that the full extent of man's life was going to be 120 years. I said, well, that's an interesting statement. First of all, I wonder, how is that possible that he could have just dialed in and said, that's the number? And I wonder if there's any verification of that number. And, of course, I was sent an article by Roy that explains how the DNA can be switched such that any number, and the number right now is 120 years, human life expectancy can be constrained to a certain amount of time. And how there's literally a switch. In fact, scientists right now are trying to figure out how they can manipulate that. And the big concern is that there is essentially an immortal cell within humanity now. In fact, there's actually the equivalent of three immortal cells within humanity. The female egg, the male sperm, And cancer cells are essentially immortal. We have cancer cells that go back hundreds and hundreds of years that are there's still being used and tested and that sort of thing. So the problem with man manipulating it is that a cell that continues to divide becomes cancerous, and the problem with the cancer cell is it can't convey everything that it needs and create the kind of structure with its rapid cell development that is stable and supportive of life. It's destructive of life. So it was interesting that there really is a switch, and that Yahweh can trigger. It's very much like evolution, when we wonder how microevolution is possible and macroevolution is not possible. It's impossible that life emerged from inorganic material, and that that it ultimately a cell of life was spontaneously created and then figured out how to replicate itself, how to find food, how to consume that food, how to use the energy from the food, and then live. I mean, it's survive in any environment. It's impossible. But it what we've learned is that that what we have thought of as junk DNA is really this capacity for our cells, our nature, to evolve, to deal with changes in the environment and the need to adapt. And so it was within every living creature was actually written into the process. That's why we can evolve in a construct where the laws of thermodynamics apply, and where information is lost when there's a mutation, we can still evolve because it was all written into the script initially. But this article that Chuck sent was a comprehensive analysis of something that I studied when I was writing that chapter. What I found is that the oldest living man died at, I think, like 115 years or something years old, and there's one woman who lived to 122. And the gist of the article is that it's essentially impossible for a human being to live beyond 120 years, that it's coded right into us, and that it doesn't matter what we do in terms of medicine, doesn't matter what we do in terms of diet, doesn't matter what we do in terms of environment. There is literally nothing we can do to live past the threshold that Yahweh established for us. Isn't that interesting?
That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, just another one of those confirmations that when he says, this is something I have done, if you want to study it, you'll find that it's exactly as he said it was.
So there's a programmer. It ain't dead.
Yeah. Now, what we left off on our review of, they have a programmer. Well, programmers can, in fact, but not if the program that you wrote was for life.
Yeah,
and you want to run an only program
you
for
can
life.
Do that. Probably
yeah, and if you can write a program in three dimensions, which is what DNA is, it's a three-dimensional coded alphabet. If you can write and have your software run on run inside of a living organism. You're pretty good.
Yeah.
What we were considering was Yeshaya 2:1-2:2. 2:2 was really the last statement that we had considered, and it says something that it's just a wonder to me as to how it is that Yahweh could say something this bluntly, and then you have so many people so ill-advised, like all those wacko fundamentalist eschatology crazed rapture ready Christians that want to know about the status of the preparations for rebuilding the temple on the Temple Mount, because their Jesus can't come back until such time as that temple is built. And you say, And you say, okay, come on. And Yahshiyah, Tutu, he told us, A, that the temple is not going to be built by man, and B, that it's going to be built coterminously with his return, and C, it is Yahweh who is returning, not Jesus, and 4, that it ain't going on the Temple Mount. Wow. And by the way, the Gentiles that are around at the time,
mm-hmm. Okay, obliterated.
The ones that actually survive the return,
mm-hmm.
The ones that survive the return are going to be glowing.
Well, glowing.
You know, there are not a whole bunch of glowing Gentiles around these days.
Shining brightly. Yeah,
shining brightly. So here's what he says. He says, "It shall come to pass, Haya. It shall be." In the last days. Now, this is the end of time as we know it. This is, we're approaching year 6,000. We are, in fact, at this point, we are in year 6,000. This is 2033 on the Roman pagan calendar of Catholicism. And it shall come to pass in the last days. Established and firmly fixed. You know, is there any time in on Yah's calendar in year 6,000 that is established and firmly fixed?
Yes.
Well, what would that be?
Well, the Moed Mikrais.
Yeah, and how about the two that at this point have not been fulfilled? Yom Kippurim and Sukkah? So it shall come to pass in the last days, because, by the way, there are 5 days that will continue. It won't be life as we know it, but 5 days left in year 6,000 Yah upon the day that he returns. Yom Kippurim is the day that he's going to return, and it's established and firmly fixed. Now, one of the things that's interesting about Yom Kippurim is I think that Yom Kippur, and I could be wrong here, and this is not what I originally thought, but it's what I have grown to think. And as I was thinking about the Moed Mikre, it's really obvious to me that the first 4 Moed Mikre exist expressly to fulfill the benefits of the covenant.
Sure.
And that's the reason the first 4 Moed Mikre have been fulfilled. You know, Yahweh made 5 specific promises relative to the covenant, that we become mortal, that we become perfected, that we are adopted into his family, that we are enriched and we are empowered. So those are the 5 benefits he made, and that the first 4 Moed Mikre enable, facilitate, each of those promises. Pesach, we become immortal. Matzah, we are perfected. Bukurim, we're adopted into his family, his firstborn children. And on Shavuot, the promise of 7, we're empowered and enriched. And then it's pretty obvious to me, since Scott played the shofar, I got my cobwebs out of my brain, that the purpose of Teruah is for those who have benefited from the first 4 Moed Mikre, especially those now who are enlightened, empowered, enriched by Yahweh's teaching.
To announce that.
Announce that. And, you know, while Yahweh has no issue with us announcing it to the world and is happy when we tell Goyim Gentiles, and he's thrilled when a Goyim Gentile joins his part of the family, the people he would most like to awaken are Yisrael and Yehudim.
Yeah,
he plays favorites. It's his prerogative. It's his universe. He plays favorites. You know, I play favorites. There's a lot of breeds, probably, 250 breeds of dogs out there. I happen to like Labradors. That's my favorite. You know, so if I was going to have, if I were going to breed dogs, I'd breed Labradors. It's God's universe. He plays favorites. So that's who he'd like us to talk to in the most part. Now, Yom Kippurim is the day of reconciliations. For those of us who have been made immortal, who have been perfected, who have been adopted into Yahweh's family as his children, who have been enriched, empowered by him, and who have been about the business of sharing with all who will listen what Yahweh had to tell us, aren't we already reconciled?
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, you know, if you're just going through this process, what in the world is reconciliations doing here, of all places, as the sixth of seven Mikra? We're already reconciled. You can't be any more reconciled than you are following Shavua. Yeah. By the time you get to Shavua, man, you couldn't be any more reconciled. And, you know, man, Teruah, you're sharing the message of reconciliation.
Yeah. But we're celebrating what he's going to do.
Yeah, exactly. And what he's going to do is going to reconcile his relationship with Yisrael and with Yehuda. And so Yom Kippurim, I don't think is about, now when I say us, mm-hmm. when I speak of there's many who are part of the covenant family who are Yisrael and who are Yehuda. I'm not. You know, I'm Irish. I'm Irish and Sioux Indian. So I think it is about Yisrael and Yehuda, whom Yahweh says he's going to reconcile his relationship when he returns. Well, they're going to reconcile their relationship with him just prior to his return, and we're celebrating that. And so we're announcing, we're facilitating, we're enabling, we're participating in, we're working together as part of this overall celebration of the reconciliation of Yahweh with his children. And of course, the first thing that they're going to have to do on Yom Kippurim is to realize it ain't no fast. You know, it's amazing that the religious Jews would have you believe that it is a fast and that you should fast on Yom Kippur. By the way, it's Kippurim. It's always presented in the plural. Day of Reconciliation. The reason it's reconciliations plural is that there's two reconciliations taking place on this day. One is between Yehuda and Yisrael, and the other is between the combined now Yisrael and Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
So his family is no longer divided nor separated from him. But this this notion of a fast, you'd say, well, where did you get that? I had somebody write me and said, you know, that there are a bunch of Torah observers that say that, you know, we're supposed to fast on this day. You know, the prophets fasted and God blessed them for fasting. And my response was, oh, we're supposed to fast on this day. Then can you please tell me why God didn't tell us to fast on this day? If God wants us to fast on this day, why didn't he tell us to fast on this day?
I call it a feast.
Well, it's actually not a feast. Not all of the seven Moed Mikra are Chag. He does use the term Chag with many of them, where he calls them festival feasts. I don't think he specifically refers to Yom Kippurim as a festival feast, but he does designate a number of them or refer to a number of them as festival feasts, as Chags, as parties. And clearly this is going to be a party. Just because he doesn't set the menu, to infer that means that we're supposed to go hungry,
mm-hmm.
is silly.
Yeah, well, we want to weaken you.
Did God give us any instructions on Pesach on what to eat?
Yes.
How about on matzah as to what we should or shouldn't eat?
Oh, yeah.
So if God, you know, and matzah says, I don't want you to have any yeast.
Yeast.
Do you think that if he on Yom Kippur didn't want you to have any food, he was capable of saying, oh, by the way, I don't want you to have any food?
Sure.
And on you get to Shavua. I mean, the instructions on the meal for Shavua are as long as your arm. I mean, it takes good part of a day just to figure out what the symbolism is of all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if God wanted you not to eat, don't you think he would have said so?
Yeah, I think he would have brought up the fact if he wanted
He's
a very good communicator.
Pretty good. And the second thing, of course, is that when you reconcile a relationship, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
That's a great thing.
Yeah, have you ever heard of a relationship being reconciled that was
they slept somebody when they...
Yeah, so, yeah, if You know, my wife and I had a little spat the other day, and do you think that when we decide, you know, it probably wasn't worth fighting over, that do you think that the way that we resolved it is to give each other a good punch in the gut?
Hardly.
And so the day of reconciliation, yeah, religious Jews want you to celebrate by afflicting yourself. It is truly astonishing. But anyway, I think that the Day of Reconciliations is a celebration of Yisrael and Yehuda coming back together with Yahweh. It's when Yosha tells the story of the prodigal son.
Mm-hmm.
He's telling the story of Yom Kippur. That's the story. I mean, yeah. And by the way, what does the father do? Does he say, "Hey, you know, the son's coming back. I want you to protect. Do not slaughter any animal. Do not prepare any food. Let's go out and beat him up because we want to really afflict him. And starving would be a good thing at this point." No, didn't he say? No, why don't you get the plumpest animal we've got out there and let's have a party. Let's celebrate this. And so that's what Yom Kippurim is about. I view Yom Kippurim as very much like how I would like my first day in Yah's home to go. Yah's been very clear how he's going to greet each of us, and he's going to get up. He's going to meet us in the way of, while we're approaching him and walking to him, he's going to get up and meet us. He's not going to make us walk all that way. Give us a big hug. And you know, I want to be in the back of the room. I just want to watch people who I've come to know, people who have been, along with myself, been the beneficiaries of what we've learned. I want to be in the back of the room and just watch the expression on Yah's face as he gets to hug those individuals and meet them. Make eye contact for the first time. I just think it's going to be wonderful. I think that Yom Kippurim is that those of us who are engaged in Teruah, we are in the back of the room as clapping and singing and smiling and watching this whole thing. You know how one of the ways that you know that interpretation is true?
Mm-hmm.
When Yosha spoke of his return, and he was quoting from Zechariah, but if you read it, it's really easy to follow in Matanyah 24, the Olivet Discourse. And, of course, if you want to understand it, you really do have to study it also in Zechariah. When he speaks of his return, what does he say about those of us who have experienced the Teruah harvest? Where are we going to be?
We're going to be coming with him.
That's correct. From the four corners of the universe. We're going to be coming with him. So
yes.
Yom Kippurim is the day of reconciliation. That's the day he's going to return.
Right.
So what are we going to be doing? We're going to be sitting in the back of the room, aren't we? Watching
it. We're
going to be. That's exactly right. So we're going to. Those who participate in Teruah get to witness the reconciliation. We aren't being reconciled. Yahweh didn't say, "You know, I'm going to ping you for the four corners of the universe." And by the way, the reason we're out in the four corners of the universe is we're out exploring.
Yeah, we've already experienced we've already left the planet.
We're the Goyim who have been adopted into Yahweh's family, who have whether it's 6 or 7 years, we've been out exploring the universe.
Yeah.
But this is a big event.
Yeah.
And so he's inviting us just to be witnesses to this event in the back of the room, watching this ultimate love affair as God reestablishes his relationship with his family.
Now, is there any merit then to this question that keeps coming up over and over and over again from people that where you bow down to Yahweh? There's no bowing down. Why would he bow down? Why would he diminish you if he's trying to lift you up?
Well, he didn't say you're going to be crawling to him.
I know.
My first greeting with you, is going to be on your hands and knees before me.
No, he actually stands up with you.